Thank you for listening to this Bible study from Calvary Chapel Whangarei. We hope you're blessed and encouraged as you listen. Today's message is from Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 1 through 14, and it's entitled The Return, Part 1. All right, Nehemiah 13. How many of you have heard of General William Booth? Founded what? Salvation Army. As they call them here, the what? The Sallies. Right? Sallies. He once said to a group of new officers, "I want you young men always to bear in mind that it is the nature of a fire to go out. You must keep it stirred and fed and the ashes removed." And how many of you have heard of the second law of thermodynamics? Yeah. Big scientific term. Okay, in a nutshell, the second law of thermodynamics says that in a closed system, all things, you know, tend towards, they call it entropy or chaos and disorder. Like if you were just to take a car and park it out in a field and just leave it for, 40 years, what's going to happen to that car over time and the elements? I mean, it's going to... Stolen, okay? That's true. But if no one steals it, it's gonna not look like this. It's not going to look the same. In 40 years, it's going to rust. It's going to slowly deteriorate, and that's the same spiritually. Without spiritual leadership, guess what? God's sheep are prone to stray, like sheep tend to do. Now, I don't know about you, but if you know that the Bible refers to His people, us as sheep, and some of you might, that might be offensive. Hey, I'm not a sheep. Sheep are dumb. They are dumb, but we're equally as dumb. Now, Moses, think about Moses, okay? Let's put this into context. Moses, when he went away from the people, he went up on Mount Sinai, right? And he's meeting with God, and he's getting the Ten Commandments. He wasn't gone very long, and what does he come down to find? The people are doing what? A little jig around this golden calf and, committing idolatry. Paul, if you go to the New Testament, Paul would start a church. He would establish a church and he would leave. And soon after he left, there would be problems. There would be trouble. And so much of the letters that we have that Paul wrote were written to churches to address specific problems, right? If you guys get cold back there, you can close that. I don't know. If you're baking or if you're... I'm nice right here, but I got the heat, so you guys decide what you want to do. But Paul would write these letters, and he would correct problems and issues. And so Nehemiah, we're going to see Nehemiah had to leave from Jerusalem. He's going to have to go back and see his old boss, Artaxerxes, and then he's going to come back to Jerusalem, and he's going to find that, man, there has been a lot of compromise going on. There's a lot of things that they have let go. So, like I said, the final chapter, and I just want to kind of bring us up to speed if you're new here, just kind of what we've done over the last few weeks, the last few chapters. In chapter 10, we saw the people reestablish certain things before the Lord. They covenanted, it's a hard word for me to get out, together to do certain things. And they promised not to intermarry. Okay, to give their sons and daughters to marry people from other nations. And that wasn't a racial thing, it was a spiritual thing. Hey, we're of Jewish heritage. We believe in one God, and these people believe in many gods, and we're not going to intermingle with that. They were going to be not unequally yoked. They promised not to do business on the Sabbath. Let's keep the Sabbath holy. We're not going to buy and sell and all these things on the Sabbath. They were going to honor the Sabbath. They promised to give of their first fruits and support the work of God, support the ministers of God, and they promised also not to neglect the house of God. And when we get to chapter 13, what we're going to see, and we're only going to see part of it today, the rest we'll see next week, everything that they promised to do in chapter 10, they break by chapter 13. And so when you get to the end of chapter 12, in chapter 11, they repopulate the city. They've built the walls, and they need people now to live within those walls. So some people volunteer. They basically do a draft, one out of every 10. You know, we're just going to choose. Hey, you got chosen. You get to go live in the city. Chapter 12, we saw that they dedicated the wall. So Ezra led one choir up the steps and on the wall, and Nehemiah followed this other group, and they went all the way around the wall, and then they met there at the temple, and they had this big, massive celebration, worship service, you know, just prayer time, just rejoicing, looking at what God had done. Now, I wish at the end of chapter 12, that was it. I wish, you know, oh, you know, the wall's been completed. They're marching on it. There's just this great, you know, rejoicing. And that would just be a great place to end. But we get to chapter 13 and we see that that's not the end. It's been said this: it's not how high you jump, but rather how straight you walk when you come down. That's what matters. So there's a lot of people that get excited about things, and maybe they go to church and they have an emotional experience, whoo, you know, and they're just excited, and then, you know, a week or two later, it's just out the door, it's just gone. And so we need to walk straight. So what we do is we find in chapter 13, the people aren't walking straight at all. They are actually walking very haphazard and crooked. And so Nehemiah, he's there, he's overseeing this project, and he had told back all the way in chapter 2 when he stands before King Artaxerxes and the king looks at him and says, man, you're bummed out. Well, what do you want me to do? And he says, well, why would I not be bummed out? You know, the city of my fathers is lying in ruins. And he goes, well, what do you want me to do? He says, let me go and rebuild. And King Artaxerxes agrees, and he says, and give me, you know, timber, and give me all these things, and an army to go with me for safe passage, and letters of passage. He requests all these things. But if you go back and read chapter 2, it says Nehemiah was asked, how long are you going to be gone? And it says he set him a time. And best that we can gather from the facts, Nehemiah had been in Jerusalem. He was there for 12 years the first time as a governor. He goes back, and we don't know how long he goes back. It could be, some have said, a year, 2 years. Some say even up to 10 years he was gone. I don't think he was gone for 10. But he goes back, and he comes back to Jerusalem, and he discovers, you know what? The fires of devotion have been extinguished. They've gone out. He discovered the situation had just radically deteriorated. The people are not living up to those vows that they made in chapter 10. Now, it also seems that Ezra, the scribe who we saw leading that first choir in chapter 12, probably at this point he's died. Because when you look in verse 13 of chapter 13, there's a guy by the name of Zadok. That's a great name for your kid if you're going to have a boy, ladies. Zadok. Okay? But he's now the scribe. Ezra had been the scribe. So it appears that Ezra has, you know, gone off the scene. But whatever the case is, needless to say, without the spiritual leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, the people don't do well. Let's pick it up and we'll read the first three verses and we'll look at those a bit, and then we're only going to go up to verse 14 today, and then we'll finish next week. Verse 1 of chapter 13, on that day they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people. And in it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the assembly of God, because they had not met the children of Israel with bread and water, but they hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the cursing into a blessing. And so it was, when they had heard the law, that they separated all the mixed multitude from Israel. Now, this is before Nehemiah has come back. Okay, Nehemiah, at this point, he's not there. He's gone. And they're reading, and they realize, man, there's this mixed multitude. Now, who are the Ammonites? Who are the Moabites? For those of you that are wondering that, it's two groups of people born from a really bad situation. There was a guy by the name of Lot, and his daughters were wanting to, you know, have progeny, wanted to have kids. They basically they get Lot drunk and they sleep with him. They commit incest and they both get pregnant. And so their descendants, the Ammonites and the Moabites, they were avowed enemies of the Jews. And somehow this mixed multitude, it had infiltrated the people of Israel, and they had purged this group of people, these groups of people, several times. This mixed multitude, the Ammonites and the Moabites, guess what? They gave Moses all kinds of trouble when he was around. And guess what? It gives the church even trouble today. I'm not saying the Moabites and the Ammonites, but a mixed multitude. And I would say the mixed multitude is this, an unsaved group or people who want to belong to the fellowship of God's people without trusting the Lord and without submitting to his will. For whatever reason, they want to come, they want to be a part of it, but they're not willing to enter in and take God at face value and enter into the promises that are there and submit and follow him. And so there's tends to be all these problems. Oh, you go to that church, but like you're living with your girlfriend. Like how to, like, so there's this mixed kind of multitude going on. They want the blessings, but not the obligations. Now, it mentions this guy by the name of Balaam. Is anyone you're familiar with the story of Balaam? Balaam was this prophet, and he was hired to try and curse Israel. But every time that he tried to curse Israel, it turned out to a blessing. If you're taking notes, you can see this in Numbers 22 through 24. But he came up with the scheme of how to get the children of Israel to basically hack God off and sin against him. And so he suggested the Moabites, okay, these people that came from this incestuous relationship with Lot, he encouraged them to be neighborly and invite the Jews to come and share in their religious feasts, which the religious feasts would have involved a lot of uniting with sexual prostitutes, temple prostitutes, and these things in their religious feasts. And so he knew that if the children of Israel did that, it would bring God's displeasure upon them. He couldn't curse them, but he could get them to do things that would bring God's displeasure upon them. And so that's what he did. And as a result of their sin, guess what? 24,000 people die as a result of that. Here's the thing. This mixed multitude in the church today, guess what? It urges us to follow the philosophy of Balaam and do what the world wants us to do. This has been going on for years and years and years, where the world wants the church to be like it. And many in the church have bought into this lie. Hey, if we're going to reach the world, we have to be like the world. And I've told you about churches that I know where, you know, they're playing AC/DC and Metallica on Sunday morning, and they're not changing the words. See, Martin Luther took old beer-drinking songs, you know, during the Reformation, and he changed the words to make them Christian. They're not changing the words. They're just singing them and trying to be cool and relatable. And, I mean, I could show you video after video, and you would just be like, what? Really? So we need to be careful of mixing and trying to be like the world. But sadly, that's what's happening. I read about a youth pastor, and just, this is crazy. His ministry, this youth pastor's ministry, was bringing many teens to Christ. He was building them up. They were learning. They were growing. And guess what? He didn't entice them with entertainment and games. Guess what he did? He simply taught them the word. He discipled them. He kept the people, you know, just busy. They were out witnessing, sharing their faith. They were meeting regularly to pray. And this church, where this youth pastor was being greatly helped by all these young people who are just on fire for the Lord. But guess what happens with something like that? We've talked about in Nehemiah. Anytime God is using you to do a work, paint a target on you because Satan's going to come after you. And so the enemy went to work. The youth pastor got called before the elders of the church and was asked this question: what is your program? I love that. What is your program for ministering to the carnal young people in the church? And his response was he had no special program for carnal teenagers, but that they were welcome to come and join in what they were doing. Come to the Bible studies, go out and share the faith, come and pray. Guess what? The elders ended up dismissing this youth pastor because he was not catering to the carnal teens in the church. And sad to say, many churches are built around how do we cater to the unbeliever? And I just need to remind you guys, the church is made up of what? believers. Now, do we want to see unbelievers come in and be welcome and be saved? Absolutely. But we can't change everything that we're doing in order to meet the needs of the unbeliever. There's certain things that we need to do as a church. We need to go through God's word. And there are churches who, they will not do what we're doing because, oh, unbelievers, they won't, you know, sit and respond and listen to that. The church needs to be doing that. That's what we need to be doing as a church, is in God's word. And we need to be showing the unbeliever that there's a difference. And sad to say, it's not happening. Now, we get to this next section, verses 4 through 9, and we're going to see an enemy intruder. And so this is really the first problem that Nehemiah is going to see upon his return. Let's pick it up in verse 4. Now, before this, Eliashib, the priest, having authority over the storerooms of the house of our God, was allied with Tobiah. Just stop there. If you remember from going back through Nehemiah, Tobiah is one of the enemies of God. And Eliashib, when you go to chapter 3, he is the guy who's mentioned as the high priest. So you have the high priest, the one who's supposed to be the spiritual leader, now in some kind of cahoots, an alliance with Tobiah. And watch how crazy this gets. And he had prepared for him, Eliashib had prepared for Tobiah, this enemy of God. Tobiah is the one that said, oh, yeah, even if they build a wall, if a fox goes up on it, the whole thing will crumble. Like Sanballat is the leader. Tobiah is like his sidekick. And Sanballat's like, who are these Jews? They're feeble. They're never going to amount to anything. And then you got this little guy, and he's kind of like the little funny joker. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. If a fox goes up, the whole thing is going to crumble. And that's Tobiah, one of the enemies. And Eliashib, basically, he prepared for him a large room where previously they had stored the grain offerings, the frankincense, the articles, the tithes of grain, the new wine and oil, which were commanded to be given to the Levites and singers and gatekeepers, and the offerings for the priests. If you don't catch what's happening, let me explain it to you. They have cleared out storerooms in the temple that's supposed to be dedicated to God for the storage of all these things for the Levites. They've said, let's clear these out and just give Tobiah a flat in the temple. The enemy could come hang out in the temple. I mean, crazy. That's all you can say. And Nehemiah's going to come back and he's going to see this. And Nehemiah's just going to go ballistic. Watch this. Verse 6. But during all this, here's Nehemiah talking, I was not in Jerusalem. All these things happened while I was gone. I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I returned to the king. So he's telling us, I had to go back, I had to report in. Then after certain days, which we don't know, could be a year, could be up to 10, I obtained leave from the king. So he's gone. And when the leader's away, the what? The mice begin to play. Okay, when the cat's away, the mice begin to play. So he says, verse 7, I came to Jerusalem and discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. I mean, unthinkable. This is just unbelievable. I mean, Eliashib's supposed to be the high priest. He's supposed to be the leader. And he's in alliance giving place to the enemy in the house of God. And it grieved me, verse 8, bitterly, and watch this. Therefore, I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room. And I commanded them to cleanse the rooms, and I brought back into them the articles of the house of God, the grain offering, and the frankincense. I mean, Eliashib is just, he's a traitor now. He's got this secret alliance going. I mean, this would be the equivalent of like having the Joker set up his, you know, base of operations in the Batcave. You know, it's like the enemy. Or you know, somebody like Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein sitting in the White House. Like, it's just like, no way. This should not be. And so this alliance, it leads, you know, to an invitation for Tobiah. He's living in the temple. He's got a flat. He's got a little mini fridge. You know, he's got a little sofa. He's got a little bed. And he's just hanging out in the temple. This thing that's supposed to be for God and the Levites. And so to make this room for him, they took all the grain, the oil and incense, and just cleared it all out. So there's two wrongs actually going on. Let me tell you what the two wrongs are. An Ammonite, this avowed enemy of the children of Israel, is now living, he's being given place in the house of God in the temple. That's contrary to the law of Moses. And in order to permit that, they had defrauded the Levites. They had cleared out everything, all these storerooms that they were supposed to store the stuff that was to be given to them. And guys, this is a great illustration of how the enemy works. See, the enemy wants to form an alliance or a friendship with us. And he wants you and I to let down our guard, get comfortable with him, and then he wants to occupy a place in our life that should only be reserved for God. That's what he does. And that place should be for God and God alone. I mean, the enemy is living in the temple, and the New Testament calls our body what? The temple of the Holy Spirit. And the enemy is living in the temple. Now, I don't misinterpret that and say, because I don't believe that Christians can be demon-possessed. But we can give place in our life to the enemy. And, you know, I would ask you a question. What Tobiah has wormed his way into the center of your life and is sitting there comfortably where only the Lord ought to be? Where are we entertaining compromise in our lives? Where are we saying, oh, this is okay, this isn't a big deal? Because Nehemiah, this was a big deal. I mean, you can just see him. I mean, verse 8, it grieved him bitterly. He wasn't just like, oh, what's going on? I mean, he's grieved. I mean, he's angry. And he threw all the household goods, out of the room. And I mean, you can just picture the scene, right? Hey, did you hear? Nehemiah's back in town. Oh, really? Where is he? He's over at the temple. And you, as you approach the temple, you see things just flying out of the temple. You know, a chair just, dishes, the mini fridge comes out. And I mean, just things being chucked. I had an experience like this at college. I agreed to room with this guy from Albuquerque. We went about 3.5 hours south to where uni was. And we went to different high schools, but we knew each other. And we said, hey, let's room together. Well, this guy had a girlfriend. And he had been out. They had been out one night. And I'm laying there asleep in my bed. And I wake up. And all I can say is they were doing things in the room that ought not to be done with someone else in the room. Okay, is that spelled out for you? And I'm sitting there, and all I can do is just put my head buried under my pillow. And then when they are done, I'm just so stinking angry. I'm like, I can't believe that you would do this. Like, you want to go do that? Don't do it with me in the room. And so guess what I did? I pulled a Nehemiah. Okay, I got up, and her book bag was there, clothes were there, and I opened the door, and I just started chucking them out into the courtyard. Boom, And then I got back in my bed. They got the hint. They left. I didn't see my roommate for 3 days. And he comes back, and he's like, hey, man, yeah, that probably wasn't cool. I said, not cool. Not cool at all. But that's what Nehemiah does. He's just so angry, and he just chucks this stuff. And let me ask you a question. Does this remind you of anything? Does this remind you of anyone else in the Bible? Who? Jesus. He cleansed the temple twice. And in one of the accounts, it says that Jesus is there and he's like making a whip. Like he's braiding. He's got this rope and he's sitting there and he's seeing what's going on. He's just like, just this. I mean, and it says he just drives them out of the temple. The money changers, they were charging all this excessive money to buy an offering in the temple. And it begs us, we need to ask this question. Is it ever right to get mad? Is it ever right to get angry? Because some people say, Christians should never be angry. Really? Because Jesus is our example. He got angry. Listen what Ephesians 4:26 says. It says, be angry. Now, notice it doesn't just stop there. There's a lot of people that they like those first two words. I'm going to be angry at the people doing abortions. I'm going to be angry at this and that. And they're angry. But it says, be angry and what? Do not sin. And it says, do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. So guys, there is a time when we are to be angry. When is that? We're to be angry over injustice. We're to be angry, okay, when innocence is taken advantage of. Okay, what are some examples maybe? Abortion, child abuse, rape, wife abuse. And here's the deal, guys. God gets angry at sin. We need to not have this picture of God as he's the, you know, loving grandfather, and he just wants to have everyone sit on his knee and just, like, God gets angry. He's righteous. And here's the thing. If God didn't get angry at sin, I wouldn't want to follow him, to be honest. God gets angry at sin. Let me ask you another question. Does God ever get angry with believers? Some of you are like, oh, never had. Does he get angry with believers? I believe he does. But guess what? It doesn't mean he doesn't love them. Think about it, okay? If you're a parent, are there times when you get angry with your kids? Are there times when you might get angry with your spouse? Are there times when we see injustices going on in the world and we get angry? Anytime I've seen publicly a kid being, you know, bullied or picked on, it's like I want to be Batman. I just want to go and step in, and I have. And sometimes the wife's like, oh, no, don't. You know, I've been with friends like, oh, I'll just leave. I go, I can't. I have to get in, and I have to do something. And I've smacked people in the head, and, you know, I'm not saying that that was necessarily right, but, okay. I mean, it was a flick to get their attention and say, stop. Okay, it wasn't like I didn't punch, okay. Yeah. But there is a place for anger. But guys, in that anger, the encouragement is to take appropriate action. Be angry and do not sin. If you see someone being abused, I encourage you to step in. Well, and sad to say, too many people are not willing to do that. Oh, you know, that's not my deal. It's not my problem. So be angry and do not sin. But here's the deal. Don't turn it into a vendetta. These people that like, they're angry at abortion. We should be angry, but does that give us right and justification to go blow up abortion clinics? It doesn't. And if you think that what I said was wrong, we can talk after. It doesn't give us the right to do that. But we can be angry about it. Let's make it personal. Okay? Do you get angry at the sin in your own life? See, that's where we need to turn this. Do we get angry when there's sin in our life? Does it grieve us? Here's the thing. We can get angry at all the sin we see in other people's life, right? We like to talk about, oh, can you believe so-and-so? And fill in the blank. But when we get up and we look in the mirror and we are honest with ourselves, do we get angry at the sin that we see in our life? Or do we ignore sin and just pretend, everything's okay. It's not really a problem. This isn't really an issue. I have it under control. I just play around with it. We rationalize our sin and playing with sin. And sometimes we'll even say this, oh, you know what? My sin really isn't that bad. My sin's not that bad. You know? There's a lot less compromise than what I used to be doing before. Or here's the best one. Compared to that person, I'm not that bad. Guys, you will always find somebody worse than you. You will always find someone that you can compare yourself and make yourself look good. I heard a story of two brothers, and these guys were rotten. These guys were scoundrels. They were the cause of much crime in this city. They were involved with gambling, prostitution, you name it. These guys had a part in it. And as a result, they had become extremely wealthy. Well, the older of the two brothers was killed in an automobile accident, and his younger brother wanted to have a nice funeral for him. But he's sitting there going like, who in the world would agree to do funeral for my brother? Everyone knows, you know, we're just scoundrels. So he approached one of these pastors of a church, and he noticed that this church was in need of some repairs and fixing, and this church was growing. They needed a bigger building. They needed, you know, a new facility. So this younger brother set up a meeting to talk to the pastor. He said this. He said, I know you're in need of a new facility, and let's make a deal. You agree to do the funeral of my older brother, and I'll give you $2 million. And that way you can buy a new building. Pastor sat and thought for a moment. He looked up and he looked at the cross hanging there. And, you know, he looked at the brother that was talking to him. And with a little grin on his face, he said, I'll do it under one condition. You give me the check right now. Brother said, okay. Went and got a check, gave him the check. Day of the funeral came, the church was absolutely packed because people wanted to know, what is this pastor going to say about this guy who was involved in all this crime? So it was just packed to the hill. The pastor began. He said, this guy that you are here to say goodbye to today, this guy was a criminal. This guy was a dirty, rotten scoundrel. This guy was a cause for much crime in our area. But compared to, and what the brother, the younger brother, had wanted to make sure the pastor would say is, and just tell everyone that he's a saint. Tell everyone that he's a saint. And so he goes on, he's like, he's a criminal, he's a scoundrel, but compared to his younger brother, he was a saint. Okay? And so that's how we are. We tend to compare ourselves with people who are worse than us. And we say, you know what, I'm actually doing pretty good. And that's how we compromise. Listen, that other guy that you're comparing yourself to, that's not who you're comparing yourself to. That other gal that you're looking at, our standard is Jesus. That's our standard. He's the model, and he's the Word of God. And there's a lot of people that ignore sin. They ignore it. Others rationalize. Others make excuses. Oh, I just can't help it. I was born this way, or I'm just, you know... I know people that they'll say they might be rude, and they'll blame it on the fact they're like Italian. Well, I'm Italian. Italians are just rude, you know, or, you know, whatever. They'll just, I'm hot-tempered because I'm such and such. You say, no, that we don't have license to do that. Now, listen to the words of Jesus. Jesus gets pretty radical in this issue of sin. Okay, Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 29 through 30. He says, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out, cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. That's pretty radical, right? Was Jesus being serious? I would say yes and no. I mean, is he actually saying like, hey, start chopping off limbs and plucking out eyes? There'd be a whole lot of people. I mean, every guy, we'd be guilty. We'd be walking around blind. We've all looked and, you know, lust in our heart. Like, you know what I mean? So was Jesus being serious? I think he was, in the sense that he's saying, hey, you got to be serious about sin in your life. If there's something that's causing you to sin, you need to cut it off. If your computer leads you into sin because you're using your computer to look at porn, you need to get rid of your computer or put some kind of blocking software on. If you don't know, you know what that is, come and talk to me. But there's things that you can do. If your TV causes you to sin, you need to cut it out of your life. If there's relationships that are causing you to sin, you need to cut some of those things off. That's what Jesus is saying. We have to take radical measures in dealing with sin. Take action. Don't allow evil things to remain. Guess what? Even if it's painful, even if it's going to hurt, okay? If you've allowed your heart to be involved with something that's evil and it's painful, give it up. God, you have to give it up. That's what Jesus would say. Like, deal with it. Get rid of it. Don't play with this. And that's what Nehemiah does here. He sees this compromise, and he just, deals with it straight away. He doesn't like get together and say, what should we do? You know, should we sit down and have a little conversation with, you know, Tobiah and see if we can work things out? He's like, get out of here. You have no business here. That's what he says. Chucks his stuff out. And Nehemiah, he could not live with the wrong going on where there was a place that was made for doing right. If you want God's best for you, if you want to experience all that God has for you, the Tobiahs in your life need to be dealt with swiftly, firmly. Cut it off. Cut it off at the root. Let me ask you a question. How much room is there in your heart for the Lord? Because sometimes we fill our lives and fill our hearts with all this other stuff in it. We have crowded hearts. There's no place for God because we have all this other stuff in there. Sometimes we need to remove stuff and ask God, search my heart, see if there's any wicked way in there. Remove it. Create in me a clean heart. That's what we need to do. So the first thing Nehemiah does is get rid of Tobiah. That's the first problem that Nehemiah deals with in coming back. What's the second problem? Well, they had neglected the house of God. They had neglected the ministry of caring for the temple and the support of God's work. Look at verses 10 through 14. I also realized that the portions for the Levites had not been given them, for each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his field. So I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together, set them in their place. Then all Judah brought the tithe of the grain and the new wine and the oil to the storehouse. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouse Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, and of the Levites, Pedaiah, and next to them was Hanan the son of Zachar, the son of Mattaniah. For they were considered faithful, and their task was to distribute to their brethren. Now, this is the very thing, back, like I said, in chapter 10, that they had said, we're going to do. We're going to give of our first fruits. We're going to take care of the temple. We're going to take care of the house of God. We're going to supply, you know, tithes and offerings so that the Levites can do their job, so that the priests can be taken care of. And they wrote their names. We're going to do this. And he's like, this hasn't been done. And it hasn't been done to so much to a neglect that the Levites, they're gone. They're not even hanging out at the temple. They are now working in the fields trying to, you know, make a living because the people have stopped giving and they're not supporting them. So they're like, we got to go. We got to go work the fields and do these things. And I love that Nehemiah, he gathers them together and he basically says, we got to change this. We got to make these things right. Now, I and the leaders of the church, we're very thankful for those of you that give and support what happens here. A lot of what happens, you know, couldn't if, you know, things, you know, weren't taken care of and, you know, people giving and people serving. And so, you know, we're grateful. But Nehemiah, he's going to contend with the rulers. There are leaders, and this word contend, it literally means to struggle or to battle. Nehemiah went to battle over this. I mean, he's going to them, he's saying, guys, this is not right. You're blowing it. Like, you said you were going to do all these things back in chapter 10, and I left, and now, like, you've totally neglected. The Levites are gone. They're working the fields because you guys aren't giving and taking care. The temple is now being inhabited by Tobiah, the enemy. Like, what's going on? He contends. Guys, there's certain things that are worth fighting for. There's certain things that are worth fighting for. No joke. Okay, went to a minister's meeting, and there was somebody there. I'm not going to say who. There's a leader of one of the other churches that wanted to come. Well, the Constitution of the Ministers Association in Whangarei, we don't believe in de facto relationships or same-sex marriage, and this leader of this other church wouldn't sign it because she didn't agree with that. And so we had a, you know, meeting, and, you know, this one lady spoke up in the meeting and said, oh, can't we just agree to just love and just let love cover over these things? I'm like, at that point, I usually don't get into it, but I'm like, I can't sit here on my hands and say nothing. I'm like, you just want us to overlook sin. Because another pastor said, well, you know, if we're going to exclude people based on, you know, this, well, I should be excluded because I, you know, I deal with anger. And, you know, he's trying to make it like we all sin. And so let's just let cover. But it's like, no, you're admitting that anger is wrong. This person's saying that same-sex marriage is not wrong. I said, we can't just overlook sin like that. We can't just compromise like that. And so Nehemiah, he comes up with a plan to get the people back on track. Now, here's the thing. We can learn so much from Nehemiah. He faces challenges and problems always head on. And, you know, it's always good to work towards permanent correction. Anyone can come and point out what's wrong. Ah, this is wrong, that's wrong. People show up at churches all the time, and why don't you do this? Why don't you have that? They're great at pointing out what's wrong, but they never come and say, I want to be a part of the solution. We see it all the time. Why don't you guys have such and such ministry? Well, you know what? Sounds like you have a heart for that ministry. How about you stick around, and why don't you head that up? Oh, no. I wasn't saying that. I was just saying, how come you guys aren't doing it? No, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to put my neck on the line. See, I'm looking for people who have an idea of how to make things right. And that's what Nehemiah did. So he comes up with a plan to get the people back on track. And what he does is he appoints these four guys, a faithful men to watch over this task. There's a priest, there's a scribe, there's a Levite, and there's a normal layman. I mean, you could say the priest, pastor, scribe, teacher, Levite. You know, he was a servant, deacon, and a layman. And all four represent the various aspects of the life of Israel. But they shared one quality. What's the one quality? They were, what does Nehemiah say? Trustworthy men. Remember in Acts chapter 6? There's this whole issue of the Hellenistic widows and the Jewish widows. And, oh, you know, the Greek widows were feeling like, ah, we're not being taken care of. And so what do they do? Peter says, hey, choose from among yourselves seven men full of wisdom, faithful, full of the Holy Spirit, that we can entrust these things. There are four qualities, really, that I look for in potential leaders. Here they are. Teachable. Teachable. They love Jesus. They have a desire to learn. They have a desire to read, study, and apply practically. They're teachable. I don't care how gifted you are, how much Bible you can quote, how, you know, much into the Greek and Hebrew you can get. If you're not teachable, you're not useful, honestly. Because none of us are perfect. We need to be willing to learn and grow. So teachable is high on the list. Guess what? Humble. Humble. Servant's heart, not an ego. You're not above doing the little things. Moving chairs, putting up signs, scrubbing toilets, you know, whatever, you know, is needed. Cooking, I mean, just any of that stuff. Now, I also look for if someone has an evident gift. You might have a gift in administration. You might have a gift of teaching. You might have a gift of mercy, hospitality, compassion, helps, whatever. That's always, you know, one of the things I look for. And last, really on that list, it's a faithfulness. Faithfulness. And I just want to re-encourage you guys with this. God is not looking for people of incredible ability. He's looking for people of availability. Here I am, like I said, here I am, send me. Lord, I don't have much to offer, but I want to be used. You know, you've heard it say, hey, we're looking for people that are fat, faithful, available, teachable. If we listen to what 1 Corinthians says, as Paul said of those who minister in the church, 1 Corinthians 4:2, moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found what? Faithful. What does faithful even mean? It means dependable. It means consistent. It means, you know, you're there. You show up. You're involved. And so those are the first two things that Nehemiah deals with. He deals with this intruder, this enemy in the camp. Gets rid of that, and he deals with their neglect of the house of God. Next week, we're going to look at how they had broken the Sabbath. They're buying, they're selling, they're doing all this stuff on the Sabbath, and they're back to intermarrying. We'll talk about those things. We don't have time to talk about them yet, but, I mean, Nehemiah's getting radical, and next week, it's going to be even more radical. If you go back and read Ezra, there's a point where Ezra was so just like, frustrated. It says that he was pulling out his own hair. You ever felt like that? Oh, she's just going to pull my hair. Nehemiah is going to be pulling out other people's hair, pulling out beards. That's why I don't shave. I mean, it's why I shave. That's why I don't have a beard. Because no one can tug on that thing. I mean, he just goes, whoo, ballistic. He's contending with the people because they had gone back on what they had said they were going to do. It's radical. Nehemiah deals with sin radically. But guess what? Nehemiah, he can be talked about as a type of Christ or a shadow even of the Holy Spirit. Jesus, like Nehemiah deals radically with sin, Jesus dealt radically with sin when he goes to the cross, right? I mean, sin was such a problem, God said, you know what, I got to send my son. You can't just keep bringing me, you know, bulls and lambs and slitting their throats and letting the blood, like, that's just, that covers it, but it doesn't remove it. See, the Old Testament, all the sacrifices, they covered sin, but see, Jesus actually removes it. And Jesus dealt radically with sin. And so we're going to come and take communion as we do, as we bring this to a close. Next week, we'll finish the chapter. We'll finish the book. I encourage you to read ahead and see just Nehemiah and all of his... But the thing that I want to encourage you is that as Nehemiah is doing this, in verse 14, and you'll see this several times next week, he's always praying. He's praying all along the way. Remember me, oh my God, concerning this. Do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for its services. And Nehemiah, all throughout the book, he's praying. He's always like, God, remember me. Remember me. God, you're great. He's always praying. And I call him maybe popcorn prayers. It may not be something that he's just, you know, sitting here for an hour doing, but just throughout his day. And guys, we can do that all the time. You can pray when you're in the car. You can pray when you're sitting at a light. You see someone walk across the street. Lord, I pray for that person. I mean, he's just always praying, and I want you to note that. He's not just getting angry. He's getting angry, but he's communicating with God all along the way, and he's taking, I would say, appropriate action. So let's go ahead. We'll close it there. Next week, we'll finish the chapter, and we'll be done with Nehemiah. But let's pray.
Thank you for listening to this Bible study from Calvary Chapel Whangarei. We hope you've been blessed and encouraged in your walk with the Lord. For more information on our church, please visit our website at www.calvaryfongare.co.nz. God bless you as you seek to follow Him.